Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Iconoclast, the game, is loaded with interesting, sometimes very difficult puzzles, and I've had a blast figuring out how to open gates, break evil machines, and get to new platforms. What I haven't had a blast with is the bad guys in Iconoclast. At one point in the game, the guards are telling each other jokes and laughing loudly. The problem here is that these jokes center around women they capture, or upset, and often with some line about how they'd really like to do some sexual act with them. They get a kick out of these, they really do, except for when one of the guards attempts to make a joke about a boy with the finest sculpted abs he's ever seen. The guards don't laugh then, they don't make any noise at all. I know this is an attempt to make you fucking hate these guys, and it works. But it feels like it's doing just a bit more than it needs to in order to get the sentiment across. These dudes are already after you, they're already the enemy. I haven't seen any lengthy dialogue exchange between them besides this. It felt like shit to read, and not in the way I think Iconoclast was trying to get across. That, and those, in fact, those are the words of our fantastic social editor, Danica Harrod, as she was writing about Iconoclast and enemies who are over the top in a bad way. They're over the top in a way that maybe doesn't quite make sense to the fiction of the game, and that's going to be our topic today for Waypoint Radio, episode 131. I, of course, am Danielle Riendo, and today I am joined by Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
And we're talking about those issues with villains that are over the top, but actually in a way that totally sucks, or is just absolutely kind of undermining the evil or the bad guy or the kind of the way they're supposed to make sense in the game. Well, I thought, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think one aspect of this, because the immediate response is like, well, duh, they're supposed to be the villains, right? It's not like this stuff isn't in the game as an endorsement. It's meant to illustrate like why these people are so bad. But the problem with that is there's a fine line between like characterizing someone as villainous and disgusting in various ways, and then using like prejudices, abuses as a way to sort of like spice up your villain. Like it's sort of like what's the nastiest shit I can put in here, and that'll be how I season your antagonists in this game. Like huge offenders in this were like if you look at 80s and 90s action movies, like the sheer number of times in which the threat or implication of sexual violence comes just out of left fucking field as a way to like further raise the stakes, like a Lethal Weapon, right? Murtaugh's daughter gets kidnapped. We've already seen so much that indicates that the bad guys in Lethal Weapon are like bad fucking dudes. We don't really need more along those lines. But then out of nowhere, there's this entire, like, oh no, like, daddy's little girl is now, in imminent risk of being sexually assaulted by this, like, creepy villain guard.
Right.
And it turned, like, that actually makes it less about, like, characterizing the villain and more about exploiting something else in order to just sort of punch up the villainousness of the character, if that makes sense.
And it really kind of ruins the stew in a lot of ways, right? If you want to keep going with that spicing up or punching up kind of metaphor, it turns it into something potentially more uncomfortable than it needs to be, or even just cartoonish in a way. There are times it can be so over the top that you don't even believe this villain anymore. Now you're sort of laughing at the piece instead of being afraid of, sort of what you're supposed to be afraid of in terms of the fiction. And that really, just sucks. It goes the wrong way, I think. I think there's a balance to all of these things. And when you just throw something in there, especially sexual assault, because that's its own kind of can of worms there. It's its own thing. It's really, really difficult sometimes for survivors to just, you know, oh, I'm watching a movie about a bad guy with a gun. Oh, and now this is what this is. And it becomes something entirely different and entirely other.
It also furthers that narrative, right, of, well, only obviously bad people commit sexual assault or are guilty of any sort of sexual violence, right? Like, good guys don't do this.
Right.
But obviously, like, this creepy drug dealer in the bad suit with an Uzi, of course, that guy's a fucking rapist.
Right.
Like, that's kind of, like, that's kind of, like, the subtextual message of a lot of this is, like, well, you know, how can you recognize someone who is likely to be bigoted in this way or violent or abusive in this way? Well, chances are it's because they're cartoonishly evil. And if you're not cartoonishly evil, you're probably all good.
You'll be fine. Yeah, of course, of course. Which is such a huge problem. And it's a huge problem in a lot of games that use this to even less subtle degree than 80s action movies, which is saying something, I think. Immediately.
Well, a lot of games still have to catch up to 80s action movies. Right?
There's one way in which they're still kind of hanging behind. The character I thought of immediately when I started thinking of this as a topic is Tobias Bruckner, the racist, basically wearing a pseudo-Confederate outfit bad guy from Turok Evolution. I think he showed up in some later Turok games as well as like a half-cyborg, who is just... I mean, basically, I think he's in the running for the most ridiculous video game character of all time. Like,
Refresh me on this guy. I was never a Turok kid.
Tobias Bruckner was a dinosaur-riding racist in the Turok franchise.
Fucking video games.
Yeah, sure, they sure are. In the Turok video games, they're one of relatively few game franchises that had sort of like a native person as a protagonist. Turok was the dinosaur hunter. Yeah,
Prey
also. I agree. Prey, the original Prey from 2006, also definitely did.
We never got the original Prey. That game was canceled by Three Realms. Don't talk to me.
Wait, really?
Prey. Yeah, like Prey. Yeah, no. Prey was originally built on what was it called? Portal technology was like the underlying.
Yeah, but no, it didn't really, like, yes, but they were the people who innovated that. Like, I remember reading the feature in CGW about, like, you'll be able to look through a door, but it'll show something completely elsewhere in the world other than the room you're in. And it was, like, mind-blowing. And the other thing was, like, each monster hunt was going to be, like, a big fucking deal, right? So, yeah, that whole game evaporated. But back to Turok.
Yeah, sorry.
Which had a
Good. It's kind of relevant because in Turok, like, especially as the sort of as the games went on, there were several Turok sequels. I don't know if you were hip to the Turok sequels. there were sort of like tribes of native people in those games, and I don't know how well they were really portrayed. It probably was in some sort of stereotypical stuff was being traded in for sure. But Tobias's entire thing was that he basically hunted down the native people, and this is in some weird alt. Like future, you know, on other planets with aliens and alien technology and all sorts of other stuff. But
this can't be till the because I only played the first two games. I played the N64 ones, Turok, and then Turok 2: Seeds of Evil. This must be because they made
this
them for
like
the PS2
Game
and Xbox.
Cube?
But I like most people, I think I was off the Turok train during Turok 2: Seeds of Evil.
I mean, I think
Is this the game where they were paying people to name their kid Turok? Are we at that stage?
I think we are. This is like 2002-ish.
Okay. Yeah, this is back when Acclaim was also making, was it not Shadowrun, Shadow Man?
Was it
Shadow Man? They made two of those.
Yeah, there were a couple of Shadow Mans. This was around the like BMX XXX era of Acclaim.
Remember
that beautiful game where you had to like, God, was it a code, or if you 100% of the game or something, you saw, like, actual digital boobies, and that was, like, a whole thing. Yeah, this was Acclaim's real time in the sun here. This was a real time.
Their beautiful swan song.
Yeah, seriously. But here, I know this is bad for radio, but I'll just put this in chat here, just so you can see what Tobias Bruckner looks like. This man is in basically Confederate uniform with long blonde hair and mutton chop. I think those are mutton chops.
Actually, I think that Are we sure he's Confederate?
He's not Confederate.
That uniform looks pretty blue.
He's not, like, Confederate because this is in an alien planet, but it's like, well, the pants look pretty gray. I don't know. He has, an accent. He has a southern accent, and he says very racist things all the time and hunts down the native people. And he also rides a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and he is the final boss of Turok Evolution. This is one of those cases where I guess it's Turok. It's so far over the top. It's, you know, on another planet, but it's just so unnecessary. Like, everything about him is unnecessary. The Wikipedia, the fandom Wikipedia page says, a frontiersman, Captain Tobias Bruckner was infamous for his extreme hatred against the American Indians and hated as a killer of their kind in Turok Evolution. So, yeah, this is definitely using racism as, like, a spice in that first metaphor. It's really kind of trying to punch up the villainy of this horrible man, and it's not really necessary, well, you know?
But one question, though.
Yes.
Is the protagonist of Turok a native as well?
Yes. Turok is a native person.
So, I guess, because the thing here is that I do wonder, like, it seems out of nowhere if you're playing this, like, you know, in terms of, like, how games generally handle this stuff and who they're generally for, it might seem out of nowhere. But, like, I don't know. Like on its face, the idea that you're an indigenous hero of Turok and the villain is what looks like a U.S. Army cavalry officer.
Right.
Who were the tip of the spear of a large portion of the North American genocide. I don't know. Like, to an extent, maybe a game like Turok should be going there.
Are you saying this could be like a Wolfenstein sort of situation where the over-the-topness is actually sort of warranted? Maybe.
I have no idea because I have not played Turok. Like, you know what I mean? Like, in the context of a train wreck, almost everything becomes train wreckish and offensive.
Sure.
But at the same time, like,
I guess what Rob's suggesting, it's not as, like, in a world where Turok Evolution is, like, a high-quality storytelling vehicle that, like, in the context of that world, that kind of character is not out of left field in the way that maybe we, you know, was discussed.
Sure.
With Iconoclast. Like, its handling may be, like, poor, inappropriate, over the top in a way that does not execute on a villain that is, like, interesting and nuanced, in a game that, you know, that,
right.
that Turok Evolution may not necessarily set up for yourself. But, I don't know that in that world that is necessarily falls into the same category. I think that is more execution, which is in some ways is related to the first point about Iconoclast, where it's like, it's the same way that, you know, I've talked on the before, like, you know, I'm constantly critical of, you know, in horror films, how, you know, sexual assault is used as a, like, really easy plot device to shock the viewer. And I think, you know, I would never suggest in the way that we always talk about, like, when we're critical of things, is like, it's not that Iconoclast can't invoke sexual assault
right.
as, like, a way of characterizing its villains. It's how it's done. It's the execution. Is it ham-fisted? If when it comes out of left field, is it purely because, like, as Rob was suggesting, like, well, that's just the thing villains do, right? It's not that you can't invoke that side of awfulness. It's that in doing so, are you actually providing appropriate, interesting characterization to the world, to its characters? And I think in the case of Turok, I think, like, you know, there's an alternate universe where maybe they do pull that off. Whereas in Iconoclast, it's, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily justified. As much as it's more, hey, like what's, you know, like we said, the thing that could shock you as opposed to the thing that actually makes sense, to sort of shade the characters with.
And there's an element of earning it too, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think where I start to get really nervous about, like, this description I'm reading in Turok Evolution, is that, like, you can, like, a character like that, I think, is earned if you are deploying the indigenous identity of the protagonist really well and handling that fairly, like, responsibly in some ways. Like, it can still be, look, you're hunting fucking dinosaurs, so, like, you know, obviously it's going to be taking some liberties. But if you're going to deploy this idea that, like, you're fighting this mass killer of natives, you know, in dinosaur land or whatever... I also want to make sure, like, I also want the game to have earned that its ability to deploy that by also showing it's maybe aware of the identities it's playing with.
Yeah,
and that is a huge and that's a test that a lot of media fails, right? Is yeah. like you want to set up like a really clear and identifiable villain, but the level of maturity and responsibility that a lot of other aspects of the story demonstrate don't really earn the ability, don't really earn you the right to then bring in a serious real world issue and insert that into the story as an antagonistic figure.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot right now. And to be clear, it's been a long time since I played this game. I watched some cutscenes, you know, this morning to remind myself of Tobias Bruckner's awfulness, of course. But it has been a while since I played that game. So I'll bearing that in mind. But I guess the test that I give, it's not the test that I give, but one thing to think of in this case is something like in Mafia 3, where you're fighting against the KKK. That mm-hmm. feels appropriate. Even though it's an over-the-top game, even though it's a, you know, somewhat of a comic book revenge story, that feels completely appropriate to go and you know, shoot KKK guys in the face, right? In the new Wolfenstein, it feels appropriate in some ways how over-the-top the Nazis act, because, yeah, they're that bad. And so that you know, kind of passes the sniff test, I guess, on a certain level. But in Turok, I don't remember it having, like, a nuanced take, you know, or really doing service to like the tribe in the game. It just kind of felt like, you know, it would be cool if we had this guy and he hunts dinosaurs and we'll make him, you know, American Indian dude, and this other guy is like a cowboy on a dinosaur and he's racist. Yeah, so it's
yeah.
Or it's desperation. Like, fuck,
yeah,
I'm working on a goddamn Turok game. Like, what can I do? I'm in a pitch meeting. Nobody gives a shit about... He's at a claim. He's like, I've got a blank slate. All right, I'm gonna fucking... It's a Turok game. No one cares about the story anyway. No one of this company's overseeing what I'm doing with this game. All right, fuck it. I'm just gonna, like, go for broke in this game. No one cares anyway.
Somebody shoots down your idea to make Columbus the villain because, like, most people still like him.
Well, it's still 2002. I mean, you got to put yourself in the time.
Yeah, it was
right?
Probably before. Yeah, that was probably a little before the turn.
Yeah. A little bit.
I think so. Mafia 3 is an interesting example because I think one other thing that it does well, and part of it is just because like Mafia 3 is only so heightened, like it only gets so cartoonish at times. But like again, the context for a lot of the stuff where you're fighting the clan and such. When you're just driving around the world and living in it, one of the things you hear on the radio a lot, you hear a lot of things on the radio that sort of set the context for the time, right? Like political strife, like arguments over, I think, the Voting Rights Act is still really controversial on the radio in the world of Mafia 3. But one of the other things is that it's also grounded with like a very realistic understanding of American racism and sort of the paternalism that defined a lot of Jim Crow, right? Yeah. Like, there's that one radio show that keeps popping up in Mafia 3, Native Son.
Yes.
Remember that? Where it's like it's a country music station, and if you don't listen carefully at first, it just sounds like it's a, you know, Southern Prairie Home Companion kind of thing, which, boy, has that reference sort of changed a little bit this year. Like, it sounds like he's just a good old boy who just fucking loves country music and celebrating, like, the notable figures in his community. But if you listen to it a little closer, it's all these attempts to wrap racism and Jim Crow and reaction in a really comfortable, cozy, homey wrapper. In some ways.
Yeah.
That's and I really like that because it shows these two faces of racism. They are connected. This guy is the public face, the one that a lot of bigotry wears in public, where it's like, well, look, I don't hate black people. I just think that and then ...
Right,
but that is connected to guys burning torches and like hunting down activists. So those two things are connected to each other, and they exist in the same context. And Mafia 3 draws attention to both, and I think that therefore, like, kind of earns its deployment of inserting, like, the clan.
Yeah,
I think it's also a you know, Daniel, earlier you invoked Wolfenstein and how it in a cartoonish world gets away with dealing with some really tough and serious subjects. And I think that's it's when you see Wolfenstein seemingly effortlessly get away, and not even get away, earn and pull off, yeah, like switching between tones, that it only underscores how impressive those games and other games that are that manage to switch tones, that manage to exist in worlds of hyperbole. And, you know, in the same way that I think people credibly can argue that, like, it's difficult sometimes to reconcile Wolfenstein's cartoonish gameplay with its, like, much more serious and sober-minded cutscenes. I'm here for that dissonance, and it's part of the thing that attracts me to that game. But part of what a lot of what makes it work underscores how difficult it is to do that. So I think studying games like Wolfenstein provide are sort of instructive in deconstructing why other games aren't able to do that, because if you were to put Wolfenstein in other hands, it wouldn't work, right? Like, right. I think you gave everyone the same setup tools. A lot of what Wolfenstein was working with, I think a lot of lesser developers would not have been able to make it work nearly as well as it does.
Yeah, totally, totally agree. And I think as we were kind of talking about this and thinking about some of this, and where it does fail, where maybe some of the setup even works, but maybe the execution does fail. Rob, I know you were going to invoke Bioshock Infinite in here as well as something that makes a genuine attempt, at least at first, to invoke some really, really difficult material and then loses its way, perhaps, we could say, in a couple of ways.
Or maybe never really finds it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, even setting aside the fact that in the first minutes of the game, the sort of town fair turns into a trip into racism Disneyland.
Right.
Which gets pretty weird. Like, literally the precipitating event of the game is the throw a baseball at a mixed race couple.
Yeah.
It's just a bit cack-handed. But remember what follows that is your first enemy, like the first sort of thread that you're following is you're fighting the,
Cops,
what are they?
Right?
The Order of the Raven?
Oh, those guys. Yes. That's definitely in that section. Yeah.
I can't even remember. I literally can't remember their name.
Disappearing bird people.
Yeah. Yeah. And they like worship the raven,
the
but
murder
it's also
of crows. That's what that power is called. So something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like,
yeah,
you go to their, like, it's clear that they are basically the Columbia version of the Klan. Like,
yeah,
everything they do is sort of centered around, you know, racial oppression, racial violence. But for some reason, it's also bound up with this, like, worship of the figure of the Raven. And their, like, lodge, their Klan lodge is, like, a raven roost, but they've got like these elaborate feasting tables set up that have all like rotted and basically become compost. It's very Resident Evil 7 in some ways,
yes,
as you're wandering through it. And it's like, I don't even know what the hell is happening there. Like, what is this meant to evoke? Because at no point does it ever convince you really that, like, this never feels like an organization that anyone would actually join. Right, like,
right.
No matter how racist you are, I don't think anyone's gonna be like, oh man, fuck, I can't wait to go down to the lodge and like eat some compost while Raven shits on my head, like. But that's kind of the picture that the environmental storytelling of Bioshock Infinite ends up painting, and it goes to this, like, it's taking a bad group of people with. A group of villains with resonant real-world associations, but then reimagining them to be, again, cartoonishly and almost impossibly, like, evil and just gross, right?
Yeah.
It's like they don't even enjoy the same human pleasures that, like, you and I do. And it's this act of, like, really aggressively othering the idea of, like, virulent racism that I think ends up being a fumble, because as we knew then and as we know better every day now, frequently, Stephen Miller aside, racism wears a very human and, you know, a recognizable face.
Yeah, just ask the New York Times. They sure are good at dropping that one in there. Very good at humanizing racists.
That's of a piece, right? Because there is this maybe instinctive desire to believe that racism and bigotry are other, and that's why the New York Times keeps writing this fucking story about like, holy shit, like, did you know that racists like buy like Barilla Pasta too? Like, isn't that amazing? Like, and it's not at all. But if you just have no understanding or you refuse to recognize that racists share a lot with anyone else in the same culture, you're going to be continually stunned at the most basic similarities between a racist and, you know, a good person.
Right.
But I think some of the difference between like where we started and like where we are at with BioShock Infinite is like, whereas like I thought it was like totally fair for BioShock to try and go down that path. I think BioShock just had bad politics, right? Like it had a bad argument. Like it set, like it, the conclusions it tries to draw, the argument that the work makes is bad, but I don't like, I wasn't against it trying to make it. I just disagreed with like every point along the way and where it ends up going and equivocating and both sidesing from A to Z. But like, I don't fault BioShock Infinite for trying to its opening moment like is a big ask, and then it's like, all right, BioShock, like if you're gonna do this, like let's go. And then it does go. It just crashes on the way to drawing like sort of a credible argument about what it's trying to say. Like I think for BioShock Infinite, like the ultimately it was like bad, shitty neoliberal politics as opposed to what we were talking about, that kind of class where it's like, you didn't need this. You didn't earn it, and you were being shocking just to be shocking. I don't know that I put BioShock Infinite in that same category. I just think it makes like a really poor, shitty, equivocating argument that doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
Yeah, that's also super fair. That entire museum set piece, whew, that's a place it goes.
If we're to take BioShock Infinite to its logical conclusion, it's like if there's an alternate universe where BioShock Infinite is like a case where someone else given the same tools, I think, could have done something interesting with it. It's that Ken Levine was not that person.
Yes.
As it turns out.
Yeah, as it turns out, as we would say, that game is 5 years old very soon, and that is very, very interesting. Patrick, actually, both Patrick and Rob. Rob, you were mentioning something. You mentioned Resident Evil, and that's one of the places I kind of wanted to go. Because, Patrick, I know you are a Resident Evil fan. Mm. And there's a couple of... I don't know if Code Veronica was high up on your list at any point in life. But there's actually a villain there that is, like, super queer-coded. That's another issue, but it's a related issue, of course. Of making a villain... this is Alfred Ashford...
When did that game come out?
Oh, God. 98? 99, maybe? Maybe 2000?
Patrick. Because this is crucial to, like, my interpretation of that game.
I played Veronica. Let's see. 2000. February of 2000. So, we're talking almost 20 years ago.
It was, Code Veronica was, like, a big exclusive at the time for the Dreamcast. It was, like, the... it was a really big deal at the time, and I was if that's 2000, then I was 15, and let's just say Patrick, 15-year-old Patrick, didn't have a good sense of like the politics of Resident Evil Code Veronica. Patrick, 15-year-old Patrick, was more interested in what this meant for the Umbrella Corporation and the mythology of the Resident Evil series than like what it meant. Like I'm not sure 15-year-old Patrick like had a good sense of like. The LGBTQ community, let's say, growing up in a predominantly white, straight suburb of Illinois. But it's a really interesting game to look back at.
Yeah.
I don't know if for good. I couldn't tell you enough about what happened in that game, other than there was a queer coded character. But I don't know if, like I said, I don't think Patrick, 15-year-old Patrick knew the word queer probably at the time necessarily, other than like overhearing it. Like, have you looked up much of that character and how it's sort of presented in the game and like what that says?
A little bit. And also, I haven't played this game since the Dreamcast. So yeah, this is a while ago for me too. This is before I was even remotely out or knew I was queer in the slightest. But I do remember it being, like, striking a chord and being pretty memorable.
Oh, yeah, I remember being like, this is fucking weird.
This is something, yeah.
But I don't know that, like, my response to that went beyond that, which makes me wonder in retrospect, like, you know, was it being, and I say this again without watching cutscenes or, like, going back and, like, doing my own, like, actual reinterpretation of it, like, you know, how much of that was like, oh, you know, that's like weird? Queer people. So let's put a weird thing in this game because other people are going to think it's weird because Resident Evil mythology is weird. I don't even know if that's true. Maybe the game is more subtle about it than that.
But it's not subtle.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
sure.
It's not subtle at all. Alfred is, I believe, supposed to be a character who identifies as a man, but dresses in his sister's clothes. This is not a spoiler because this is a 20-year-old game, but he wants to emulate his sister. That's a whole thing that happens. So it's probably a little bit transphobic as well, if you want to like really look at it. This, I don't think this would play. Now, I will say that. I will definitely say that. I think people would get some shit for it. But this is sort of another aspect of that, like, over-the-top, you know, making something evil or weird by using something like, oh, queer-coding a villain. And this is as old as film, basically, right? Is sort of queer-coding a villain to make them even more evil and weird. It's to, like, give them supposedly, you know, stereotypical queer features, like having, you know, a specific way they talk, having a specific way they walk or dress or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And queer coding is, for villains anyway, and especially for villains that have nothing to do with, you know, there's no other remotely positive representation of queer people in the work where it's like, oh, this he's evil because he's gay, where that association could be made, basically, is its own area of this. It's in a lot of older games. It's in a lot of movies. I mean, you can also see this in 80s action movies, for sure. 70s action movies, everything. But it's another sort of aspect of this that I find interesting and also, like, it's troubling in a way. But again, I don't think necessarily that you would get away with this today. I don't think that a major game company could put something as bad as Alfred in a game and not get at least some backlash about it, which is maybe comforting in a way. Maybe it.
Well, hold on.
Yeah.
Far Cry 4.
Yeah. Like, I mean, he was like, super queer coded. I agree.
I don't know how I feel about that character either.
Sure. Yeah.
It kind of worked for me at the same. Like, it was, he was an ultra violent, like, aesthete in some ways.
Yes.
Who, like, and I don't know, there was kind of a fun goofiness to the entire thing, but at the same time, there was an element of, here's this, like, flamboyantly queer character, and that is part and parcel of his murderousness and amorality.
Yeah. And they sure went out of their way to be like, I like women! They have him talking about how much he likes women all the time, where it's like, okay, game. Like, it's almost as if they sort of realized that too late. You know, they built this character, they sort of put all of this in, they were like, shit, let's record some dialogue that at least makes him bi. You know, that's like very like, oh, just make sure we don't have the queer coding go too far in this. Although I always wonder if it's a deliberate thing. I always wonder, especially with games that have a team of God knows how many hundred working on them. I'm always curious who figured something out really late and threw something in. That's like its own kind of thing, right? But yeah, I we can probably move on to letters soon. Obviously writing is always hard. Writing fiction is always hard. Writing fiction in extreme situations is always hard, especially for all this, you know, genre stuff. I mean, all of the games we've talked about are over the top in some way. Resident Evil has never not been over the top. Obviously, you know, the Wolfenstein games are over the top in their own way. And Turok has never not been over the top. So you're always sort of playing with exaggeration with any of these characters and with any of these worlds. But it really does seem to me that finding a balance between that and making your characters evil because of their actions and not because of who they are or based on the sort of weird identity politics of a neoliberal sort of worldview, it seems like the way to go, in my opinion.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But yeah, we can move into some letters. We've got some good ones. As of course, as always, if you have a letter, if you have a note for us, you can reach us gaming@vice.com with the subject questions. We have a couple of nice, relevant questions, or at least somewhat relevant questions, here today. I think they're not really about bosses, but they are about sort of implicit and weird things. So we have Kate, two times, from Australia. Kate put two times at the end of her name here. And she writes, "Hi guys, I was wondering if you've ever played a game and ended up focusing on things that were totally not the point or intention of the game developers. The thing that specifically made me wonder that was I've been playing Stardew Valley in Pocket Camp, and I can't stop thinking about how I guess Mayor Lewis is creeping around my farm every night between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. to collect my goods to sell, so that's weird. Where does he sell them? Does he sell them for a cost and it's just a generous service, or is there some kind of weird black market I don't know about? Who is buying this stuff? And how does that fishing store stay open? The only person who shops there is me, and I never shop there. And in Pocket Camp, why do all these animals have so many pieces of steel? Where are they getting it from? Is there a smelter somewhere nearby? Why can't I buy it with my actual money? I can only get it as gifts, and they are in fact direct transactions of goods and services. And what does that say about our attitudes to labor and capital?" Okay, maybe that one is a bit much. On a more serious note, I was nodding along vigorously with Rob saying he used to play a lot of strategy in war games. I can't even play Civilization anymore because wars are bad, and so I never start wars, and I lose them, and I'm sad. Is there a game or a type of game where you end up thinking about a side note or throwaway mechanic more than the actual game?" Oh, good.
I can't think too much on those lines, but I do know that when the Doom reboot came out a couple of years back, one of my favorite stories that I wrote for Kotaku was it's not a conspiracy theory because I believe in it. It's a reboot, but it is not a remake. It is actually canonically in line with the Doom franchise. The plot, like Doom 2016, takes place within a timeline that can be connected back to the other Doom games. The theory that is proposed is that Doom 1 and Doom 2, like the way that Doom 2016 ties in is because of a change to the ending of Doom 2 made when it was ported to the Nintendo 64. Read my post. It makes sense. Doom 2016 is canonical. I choose to believe there are even ties to Doom 3, and why that feeds all in together is the truth. It is the way. I continue to believe that theory. I'm going to take it to my grave. And so that's one of those. This is where I got really far down a rabbit hole in a way that was a lot of fun. I think I justify my theory in the article I wrote.
I need to read this because I genuinely love that shit. Like, I love it when people like make interesting theories about how things connect and here and there, and like almost conspiracy theory kind of stuff going on. It's very fun in the context of very goofy universes to me. Like, I don't like that in the real world, but in Doom, give it to me.
And as far as I know, id Software, Bethesda did not respond to my. I don't think I sent a request for comment. Let's say I did, and they didn't respond. #Hashtag release the memo. You know, to give me the information I'm looking for. id Software, let the people know. Is Doom 2016 canonically in line because of Doom 2 Hell on Earth's port to the N64? Let me know.
I do want to know. Let's hope. Let's send another letter. What if like. You know, they sent it to, like, the wrong email address or something. And that memo is just floating out on the internet. Like, that's important.
It would change your full understanding of Doom.
Hell yeah, it would. And also my conspiracy theory would be correct, so.
Here you go. That. Rob, how about you? Do you have any like underlying feelings about a game or a mechanic?
I mean, I'm sure I do, but it's proving difficult to really put my finger on any. I think something that there are two things I find increasingly hard to make myself do in EU4. First is colonization. Don't really like playing with that aspect of the game. And part of it is just because, like, I'm really there for the intra-European wars. So I'm not really, like, who needs the New World when I can, you know, take a hammer to the Holy Roman Empire one more time? I'm always up for that. But then the other thing is that, like, in so many words, EU4 100% has, like, ethnic cleansing in it. And in part, like, it's not done in, like, a gleefully cruel or sadistic way, and it's not even necessarily, like, certainly elements of genocide are implied there, but a lot of it also is implied by, like, you are just slowly, like, via language laws, via, like, acculturation and promoting of certain cultural centers and the annihilation of others, you are basically changing the cultural and ethnic identity of certain regions.
Oof.
And the reason you'd want to do that in EU4 is because if you have an empire that manages, like, if you have a multicultural empire that is big enough that it has large populations of different ethnic groups, it can eventually, like, make them core to the identity of that empire. So you can have, like, a multi-ethnic, like, super state. It can be done. But even in that case, the odds are good that there's still going to be small minorities within your empire that are not going to hit that threshold, and they will feel not represented by the empire. They won't feel any allegiance to it. And then, because of that, they will always be sort of restive, and when the age of nationalism comes along, probably rebellious. So, if you really want to keep things quiet at home, you start sort of trying to, like, make your empire ethnically and culturally homogenous. And again, like, I actually think it's pretty well handled in that game. I think they've come up with some pretty clever ways to represent these tensions. And, like, by the way, like, trying to create a super state on the back of, like, mass genocide and annihilation is also, like, pretty, like, it's not really a winning play in a lot of ways, because, like, your entire, all your effort turns into, like, basically tamping down other identities within your empire, and you never, like, develop. You become a shithole. God, I hate how many words just become loaded, by the way. God, fucking 2018. You become a really dysfunctional state.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, this mechanic exists. I find it increasingly hard to press that button and be like, well, time to homogenize the Balkans. Because, like, there's context there, there's history, and I'm just like, I don't know if I want to do this with my time in this game.
Yeah, talk about that hidden curriculum right there. It's, I mean, it sounds like it cuts both ways, which is interesting.
Yeah, again, like, I think the reason I still, like, love the game is because it does sort of, I think it does handle the stuff responsibly. Like, I think but it's that fine line between you're trying to represent something, like, neutrally and objectively, and just, like, trying to say, like, look, these are dynamics in history, and we're not running from them. But then at the same time, in the eye of the beholder, for all I know, there's somebody who's playing games like that and being like, yeah, now I can really, you know, I can really create my bohemian super state and death to, you know, the Balkan dogs.
That sounded really specific right there. I don't know if you're trying to tell us something. A lot of my stuff around this is very, like, I was a kid who needed to have sort of, like, a backstory to everything. And I'm pretty sure Star Wars did this to me because, you know, I read all those, like, really goofy, like, Star Wars short story books that had, like, a backstory for every single character who ever had screen time ever. Yep. Like,
Tales
from the Cantina, where it's, like, every single person in the space bar had a whole story. And, of course, they, like, interacted with the galaxy's best and a thousand times. But yeah, like, I had to have a backstory for, like, all the Donkey Kong characters, like all the like bad guys in Mario games. There's definitely like a God, what are they called? Sniffits? Something like that. The in Super Mario Brothers 2, the Shy Guys, of course they're called Shy Guys. I don't know why I thought it was named Sniffits. They had
I'm really wondering where you pulled that.
I'm sorry. I also made names up for everybody because I was a weird kid. But yeah,
wait,
I had like
names to. So wait, that was you called the Shy Guy the Sniffit?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know. They had weird noses. They were Sniffits.
But they were good. Do they even have noses?
I mean, it's like a mouth, I think, really. But listen, back in my day, I'm old, okay? I'm going to be 34 in about 2 weeks. I had to make up names for things because unless you read the instruction manual, which I also did, you didn't know the names of things because there wasn't like a really great representation of what it actually was in the real world. So, you know, with pixel art, with old pixel art, you kind of made shit up a little bit, you know, in my day. But yeah, I had like names for specific things.
33 in a week. Let's don't try and like pour this like, oh, I'm old and I did weird. You just did weird shit. You just did weird shit. We had manuals back in my day. Danielle, just own your shit. Like, I'm 33. Fine. I'm not that far away from you.
Fine. I was weird. I'll admit it. I was weird and I had names for all the characters. And there was one shy guy who is in like one room. There's one room, and I don't even remember what world, but there's one room where there's a shy guy who's walking really, really fast in Mario Brothers 2, and I had like a whole backstory for that guy. Why he was running fast. I think he had to like catch a bus or something, or a magic carpet. There's a whole thing. I used to just make up like the stories, the backstories for all the like weird incidental characters in my games, and I didn't have, you know, a million games. I think like most kids, you kind of got a couple of games a year maybe, or you rented games or whatever, so I sure played my games over and over and over and over again and sure made up a story about everybody. Yep, because I was normal. That's that's good. All right, we got one more question. We don't have a name on this one, but what memories or memories of accomplishments in games have you later found to be entirely wrong? For years, I have been boasting that I beat the last boss in Okami, having lost all but one heart on the first version and beating the rest with half a heart. I remember very explicitly hiding behind rocks and barely jumping out to attack in a very white background. Well, with the Okami HD release, I've been rocking the hell out of the game. I beat it again, and contrary to what I'm convinced I remembered, the boss was just a bunch of balls. No rocks, no white, just balls. Balls with stripes on them that look like they came
Deja vu.
From the S-Grade franchise. All right. So, does anybody else have entirely false memories of games or entirely false accomplishments that you had in a game that you later were like, that didn't happen? What was that about?
Oh, man. Like, just stuff aggressively misremembered, huh?
Yeah. Just like, okay. I remember it looking like this, and it really was just not even. Or even, I think you could do something that you thought was like really difficult as a kid, then later on kind of looked back on, and you were like, oh, wow, that wasn't that bad. Or vice versa. You had an easy time as a kid, now it's very difficult.
I mean, like, every time I go back to a game, like, so, like, basically all the 3D games from, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, like, Deus Ex is a perfect example. I remember that game looking pretty good.
Yeah.
If you asked me, like, I would say, like, that, yeah, that game probably still looks pretty good. And then if I actually see screenshots, or if I, like, fire it up on my PC, I'm like, holy shit. Like, how did this, like, do you remember, like, how character models in this era were all basically, like, cube-headed?
Yeah.
And just, like, everything was like a texture applied to a different face of the cube. Yeah. And it wasn't really a whole lot more like subtle than that. That's not how I remember any of this. But every time I see it, I'm like, oh dear God, this is a disaster. I mean, I remember the Von Braun in System Shock 2 being much bigger than it actually was. Like, I went back and played that a while ago, and I remember like the MedSci deck being this like massive, expansive, like opening level, and it's really not. You know, it's really a few hallways and you know, major like hubs, you know, at the center of it, and then little hallways spoking off of it. But I remember it being this like really expansive, you know, explorable space. And I just convinced myself that like that spaceship felt bigger than it is. And I think it feels big because you're basically in mortal terror the entire time. But like if you go back to it now and you're like, you know, you're a big boy and you're not scared anymore, you're like, oh, this is I mean, this is a this is a pretty small apartment.
Yeah. It's not exactly a false memory, but I guess it's a false memory of how mature and well done something is. So sorry to pick on BioShock. I still love the first two games. I'm you know, not saying that they're not really good games. I think BioShock 1 and 2 are great. But I distinctly recall thinking that the environmental storytelling, let's say, in the first BioShock was a whole lot more subtle and detailed and, you know, ready for people who don't play video games than it clearly was. I remember teaching a class at Northeastern University, and it was not a game design class. I teach game design as well, but like this was not a game design class. So these were not game designers. This was a interactive storytelling class, and it, you know, traded heavily on sort of like cinema students would take this class. And instead of like picking something effective and good and subtle and interesting, I picked the intro to the medical pavilion as my sort of like, look at how beautiful and subtle and masterful environmental storytelling can be in a video game space. Look at how mature we have become. This is like not 2007 either. This is like 2010, 2011. It's been a couple years at this point. There were other options for me. Just to make clear. And if you don't remember this, basically there's blood on the floor and there's some like bodies strewn about that have been clearly cut by the surgeon. The story of this space is Dr. Steinman, who is that, you know, sort of the mad scientist trope who, you know, he went mad because he had too much Adam in his system. And now Adam will allow him to do amazing things with the human body, and he, you know, goes off in his voice logs about it. And so I was showing these, like, you know, it was sort of like gameplay that had been cut into, oh, only the, you know, the most stirring pieces of environmental art, and then, you know, the sort of voice logs. And I'm standing there, you know, showing my class this, and they're like gasping, like, this is disgusting. What is this? Like, these are not gamers. I mean, the gamers among the class were like, oh, yeah, this is all right, I guess. And every other student is like, this, oh my God, what is this? And I had another teacher from like the next classroom run in and be like, what are you doing? Because, of course, it's like gunshots and blood noises and just sort of the violence of it. It's just so ridiculously over the top and so not subtle.
Man, what a great game.
And I sure was, like, humbled. I ate some humble-ass pie after that lecture where I was like, oh, this will be so good. And then it was like, oh, my God.
Did you even get to the part where you sort of, it's the reveal of Steinman and he's in the middle of, like, botching the shit out of a plastic surgery?
Yeah.
And oh, it's so good. He's just like just mutilating a figure on an operating table,
and it makes noise at first. Then it's dead. It's one of those. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he's like, ah, none of them are my masterpiece. And then he like gestures at one thing, and the light comes up on another dead body. Gestures at another, and like he's like installed track lighting for like his mutilated
just
corpses.
For this.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
yeah.
So good.
We got to that, but I had to lower the volume considerably because it was scaring people in the university. So, yep.
I suppose I next you're going to tell me that Xander Cohen was a bit over the top.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You want to talk about queer coding in your villain? There's one for you right there.
Yeah, but Fort Frolic is above reproach. I say that having not played it in like 10 years.
I play it
every
few years.
I'm sure there's nothing problematic there.
Oh.
But
yeah.
I fucking love that level. Fuck it. I don't care. I love Xander Cohen.
I feel like the first BioShock still holds up and still where I played. The last time I played it was last fall. The collection came out and I played at least a few hours of the first one again. I play that game like every few years because I actually really like it. And it holds up, but it holds up as like fantasy murder theater, basically. Like, it's not, it doesn't hold up as like the greatest game to comment upon the making of video games and why we do what we do. It doesn't hold up like that, but it does hold up as like, look at Fantasy Murder Theater 2007. Like it's very fun in that way. So yeah. Yeah, correct. All right. I guess we're out of time now. We could talk about villains that are too over the top all day because we play video games. But alas, we have to go back to our jobs, or the rest of our jobs. This is part of our jobs, of course. But if you do have a question, you can always send it to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Just put question in there so we know where to put it. As always, shout-outs to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We are on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. And we're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice as well. You can read everything that we write at waypoint.vice.com. Patrick, where can people find you online?
Find me at Patrick Klopik.
Awesome. Rob, where can people find you?
At Rob Zachney.
You can find me at Tobias Bruckner Hater 007. That's my... No, I'm at Danielle R.I. And man, fuck Tobias Bruckner. That's just the message I have for you today. As well as, thank you for listening. Be good, and be good at it.
Peace.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.